Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
President Jefferson, are you there? This is John.
Citizen, it's good to hear your voice.
Likewise. Happy holidays in advance to you. Did you all celebrate Thanksgiving in Monticello or in Washington, D.C.?
No, I did not. I was asked to declare a national day of Thanksgiving during my presidency, which was between 1800 and 1808, but I refused because I didn't see it as the purpose of the United States government. The government does not have any reason to inform or persuade citizens about their religious observances.
Oh, boy, you so wouldn't recognize this place if you saw it now. I mean, we pardon the turkey, we light the tree, we have choirs of all faiths come through the White House. I'd say it has generally a Christian bent in America, but it's celebratory, if even not religious. You guys, the presidency is totally in on the holidays, Mr. President.
Well, in my time, we believed that the government of the United States existed for certain limited, enumerated purposes, that it was to deliver the mail, to protect our coasts and harbors, to settle disputes between Maryland and Virginia or Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and that it had no right to intrude itself into the heart of man or his mind or his conscience. And so even though Thanksgiving harvest festivals seemed to me to be a good idea, I insisted that they be undertaken privately and not by official government interference.
Well, let me ask you, what would you do with this? Say at Jefferson Tech, the university there. What was the university that you founded, University of Virginia?
The University of Virginia at Charlottesville, the last of my triad of achievements.
Okay, so what were the big three for you?
The Declaration of Independence in 1776, of course.
Right.
The most important document in the history of human liberty, not because I wrote it, but because of the philosophy of natural rights that it espouses.
Right, right, right.
And the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, which was 1786, and that's the one that separated church and state and disestablished the Church of England as the official church of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Man is free to worship the religion of his choice. And then finally, after I retired from the presidency, I wanted to do one more thing, which was to create an institution of higher learning that was purely secular and that would perpetuate these principles of liberty and natural right to the next generation and the next.
You don't include being twice president of the United States on your big three?
Certainly not. That was just a public duty. Anyone might have done that, and others did and do. I regarded the presidency, I suppose, the way you regard jury duty, as something we do for the good of the community, but we don't take much credit for it.
Funny, now we don't even let them serve on juries. Okay, so suppose there you are at the University of Virginia. You guys have a swell basketball team. They're in China. They're taking on Georgia Tech or somebody as the NCAA wants to extend its brand across the globe. Bear with me. Anyway, while over there, a couple of the players on your team are caught stealing from a high-end Chinese retailer some Louis Vuitton sunglasses. What would you have done if then they, I don't even know that they asked, would you have intervened on behalf of those students to get them out of China and out of jail?
Yes, to a certain degree. First of all, if they committed a crime under the laws of another nation, they have put themselves in a very vulnerable situation, and they may be forced to pay the consequences. But it's in the interest of the United States to do whatever we can to lessen the difficulties of any of our citizens, even when they're guilty. And so I would have worked with diplomats from China or through intermediaries to suggest leniency and to hope that they would be as respectful of America and her citizens as they possibly could be while retaining their own national self-respect. But I wouldn't feel much sympathy for these perpetrators if they were proved guilty.
Well, let's assume that they're guilty because we have this thing called videotape now or video, and they got them dead to right. You can watch them steal the glasses. I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask you this same question when we're on stage December 2nd at Elgin Community College, and I beg you to reconsider it. Why not leave them over there as long as possible and let them suffer the legal consequences? If they're given unfair treatment, then fine, intervene or get somebody to intervene. But for the President of the United States to ask the President of China for leniency on people who I think should be in jail in China right now, I think that's beneath the office.
Well, I agree with you that this does not rise to the level of the presidency of the United States. And for the president to attend to such things demeans his office and makes it appear that he's no more than a mayor or a city councilman.
Right.
But I
really
do think it's in the interest of the American diplomatic community, perhaps the ambassador to the People's Republic of China, to say, look, we always have an interest in our own citizens. We don't want to interfere in your own systems of justice. But if you can in any way make this as lenient as is acceptable under your own sense of national pride, we would appreciate it. I don't think that's asking too much. I think you're suggesting that we turn away and wash our hands of these.
Yes, yes.
They are American citizens.
Ah, no, well, they're fine.
Well, you certainly are a much harsher hanging judge than I would ever have been.
Okay, so I've been reading a book called Undaunted Courage. It's about the Lewis and Clark. Now, I'm going to have two conversations on December 2nd at Elgin Community College here in the Chicago area. One will be with you, but I'll also have a conversation with Meriwether Lewis, and he will tell what I describe as the greatest American adventure story ever told, and that is of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So I'm reading about it, and there's a couple of things that I think we go, oh, yeah, Lewis and Clark, they went west and tried to find a water route to California or something. We're not real clear on that. And there's a couple things that when you think about what they did or tried to do, what they did, it's hard to believe. It's hard to get your mind around it. I have a couple questions for you about this. Do you have a minute?
Yes, let me start by saying that I always called it the Lewis Expedition and not the Lewis and Clark Expedition because Lewis was my protege, and he in turn selected Clark as his co-captain.
But they were both cool with that, right? Lewis was a big Clark fan. He was okay.
Lewis knew that he probably would not have succeeded, or at least not in full measure, without a coadjutant, and he had worked with Clark in the Army some years previously and had great respect for Clark, as I did for Clark's older brother, George Rogers Clark, who was a hero of the American Revolution.
Yeah. All right, so I got a couple questions about that. I have to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back. You got a minute, sir?
Certainly. Of course, sir.
And by the way, just one last thing. I mean, weren't you the kind of guy who would tell a kid, hey, listen, if you break the rules, then you've got to suffer the consequences, mister? And so if you're in China and their rules are tougher than ours, well, then I guess you're going to be in China for a while. I can't believe you're not saying that. When we get on stage at Elgin Community College, I'm really hoping that you're going to come around to my way of thinking on this.
Well, that would be, of course, the case in all of your questions.
It certainly would. All right, back to the Lewis expedition in a minute on WGN. President Jefferson, third president of the United States on a phone line. Imagine that. So have you changed your mind about that Longelo Ball kid that was caught stealing Louis Vuitton sunglasses in China yet?
I certainly don't approve of any American misbehaving in foreign countries because they all are representatives of our own country, and particularly if they are selected representatives of one of our institutions of higher education. So I am certainly stern about it as an American, but I also believe that it's every diplomat's duty to serve the interests of our American citizens as well as he possibly can, even when he has to hold his nose while doing so.
So Lewis and Clark set off from St. Louis, essentially, right?
Well, St. Charles, you know, the mouth of the Missouri, just a few miles north of St. Louis. That was May 14th, 1804.
And they went 8,000 miles over 28 months. Is that about right?
Right. 7,689 miles is the number Lewis sent to me upon his return, and they only lost one man, and he died of natural causes.
Okay, so this is what I'm thinking. Doesn't the Missouri River go from, like, St. Louis, North Dakota, South Dakota, heading towards, you know, Wyoming, Colorado, Idaho, that direction?
Well, up to a point. It flows from something called Three Forks in Montana,
right,
in southwestern Montana, up towards the Canadian border, and then turns in North Dakota down on a long descent towards St. Louis.
Okay. My question. So that's the sort of geography of this thing. So if you're going to use that as a way to go west, aren't you going against the current then the whole time?
Yes, two problems there. One is that you're going against the current, and the current of the Missouri is about 3 to 5 miles per hour, but there are snags and false channels. The banks are falling in. It's a very treacherous river for navigation because of its murkiness. And then the second problem is that it goes so far north. You know, you wished that it would go straight west from St. Louis, but it doesn't. And so in order to get to the Pacific Coast, Mr. Lewis and his party of about 30 had to go very far north and then through the Rocky Mountains in a place where there was almost eternal snow.
And so when they're going through the Rocky Mountains or places like that, are they carrying stuff, looking for another river? I mean, the river didn't go all the way.
That's the problem. I hope that there would be a portage between navigable waters of the Missouri system and navigable waters of the Columbia system that would be about a half day. It turns out it's about 6 weeks, and the mountains are very complex. It's not a single range. There's no Cumberland Gap as there is in the Appalachians. And so this really was a difficult problem because in our time, you need to understand, roads were rivers and river roads. The reason why they didn't go overland is that it was infinitely easier to move a large body of material and men by water than it ever could have been on land.
But when they get to the end of the Missouri, you're thinking, hey, don't worry, guys, this will be about a half a day. Like, how do you even know that? And then how do they know where the Columbia River is? If I got to the end of the Missouri and I didn't see the Columbia over there, I wouldn't know where to go. How do you find a river over 6 weeks? How did they know where to find it?
Well, without any sense of disrespect, I would say I would not have chosen you to be of this party if you can't read the land any better than that.
How do you know where the Columbia River is? You don't know.
Well,
is it Indian going
to
tell
you? The ridge, there's an intervening ridge, and nature does work through Newtonian symmetries. So when you get to the top of the ridge next to the source of the Missouri, you should look west. And there will certainly be a feeder stream there that will then feed into a larger tributary that will feed into a considerable river that will eventually feed into the Snake and the Columbia. The question is, how far is the portage and how navigable is the stream on the other side? What happened was that the Missouri is navigable almost to its source, but when Mr. Lewis climbed up to something now known as Lemhi Pass and looked west, he saw not only many ranges of impenetrable mountains, but the river that watered those mountains was not navigable in any reasonable sense of that term.
So when you guys set out from St. Louis, they say, okay, guys, this would be great. We're going to go to California. It wasn't California, but we're going to go out there. And by the way, for like a year or so, we're going to row. What was the weight of the stuff? How much stuff did you?
They carried, I think, I of course wasn't with them, but Mr. Lewis carried 60,000 pounds worth of luggage.
Okay. So he says, okay, we got 60,000 pounds of stuff on these boats that we've made, and we're going to go upstream without a motor, right? So did the guys know that? Did they know that they were going to have to push and row and pull these boats upstream?
Yes, of course, they had the right stuff, and they understood that the thighs and backs of these men were going to be the motive power by which they arrived at the source of the Missouri River. And everything went pretty well there. It was backbreaking labor from dawn till dusk. These were extraordinary young men. They would be Navy SEALs probably in your time. But when they got to the Rocky Mountains, sir, they couldn't float any longer, so they had to portage what they carried on the backs of horses that they purchased from the Shoshone and Flathead Indians, and each horse could carry about 200 or 220 pounds. So now they're reduced to about 10,000 pounds of baggage. Much of it they had to bury in cache pits on the eastern base of the mountains.
Hmm. To say nothing of the language barriers, the weather they endured. Imagine a winter outdoors like that. I read that for 3 months of one of the winters they were there, the average temperature over those 3 months was 4 degrees. It's just,
well, that would be in today's North Dakota. And, of course, they had never seen temperatures like that. Well, maybe one or two who were born in New England, but most of them were Virginians and Kentuckians, and they were truly appalled by the weather in what's now North Dakota. But you missed one thing in the concerns that they had, and that was bewilderment. They did not know what was around the next bend of the river. When you're exploring, you're the first there, and you don't have maps, and you don't have a real understanding of what lies before you, whether it's hostile Indians or a waterfall that can't be gotten around, or who knows what else, diseases that white people have no capacity to withstand. And so bewilderment and fear And being, in a sense, being lost, not being lost in the easy sense of the term, but not knowing exactly where you are and what the continent has to offer you by way of challenge, that was one of the great concerns for Mr. Lewis.
It's just an incredible tale. So Meriwether Lewis will join us for one of the programs. You will be on stage for a different program, at which time you will explain your reasoning about LeAngelo Ball and China and statues in America and impeachment proceedings and anything else people want to ask about. I'm very much looking forward to your next visit, Mr. President.
Well, I'll be sending two, of course. I'll be sending myself and then Mr. Lewis, who's a much better traveler than I am, and they both will be appearing at this college, you call it.
Yes, it's Elgin Community College. Go to WGNradio.com/events for the last of the tickets, and I'll see you soon, my friend.
Thank you, my friend.
That's your president, third of the United States, TJ.